This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Don't you hate it when a shadow comes into another nice day? All my weather worries are far away. The East Coast is grumbling under more snow. The Deep South may be freezing the Canadian snowbirds. There is another crazy cyclone over Darwin, Australia, dumping over a foot of rain in 24 hours. But hey, the sun shines where I am. Then I see the sign by the produce stand. It says, due to extreme cold in California, Arizona, Texas, and Mexico, produce prices will go up. Farmers lost nearly 80% of their crops. Expect higher prices, shortages, and lower quality. So I head over to the bread aisle and get more sticker shock. My favorite flax bread is now $5 a loaf. Pretty soon I'll need to dip into those big pails of hard red wheat I put away for hard times. May have to make my own bread. That investment went up 25% in value, by the way, in just 2 years. Gas here is $1.25 a liter, more or less $5 a gallon and climbing. There's plenty of it, but speculators are going wild as Libya shuts down production. Are the Saudis next? The headlines ask.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
I'm Alex Smith, and I can't avoid this simple fact. We are all connected now. This week on Radio EcoShock, we'll talk energy news with an eye out for the early stages of oil depletion, while solar power just gets cheaper. Dr. Jeremy Leggett, geologist, oil expert, climate campaigner, and British solar entrepreneur, joins us for a no-holds-barred talk of the world. Later, we'll get back to solutions from the transition movement, but this time our guest, Carolyn Baker, suggests we need to look deep inside. Are you really ready for the wild changes coming up in the next few years? Carolyn gives us tips from her new book, Navigating the Coming Chaos, a handbook for inner transition. All the music you'll hear comes from the new Radiohead album, The King of Limbs. I started all this with the price of vegetables. One of the largest distributors in North America, Sysco, sent out a notice saying, quote, "The early reports are still coming in, but most are showing losses of crops in the range of 80 to 100%. Even Shadehouse product was hit by the extremely cold temperatures. It will take 7 to 10 days to have a clearer picture from growers and field supervisors, but these growing regions haven't had cold like this in over half a century." End quote. We don't know why this happened. For sure it is climate disruption. For what it's worth, I'll give you my own very inexpert opinion, based on a bunch of news releases, articles, and recent statements by scientists. In places like wonderblog.com and climateprogress.org, you will find articles about the possible relationship between a surreal warming in the eastern Canadian Arctic and the blast of cold air moving into the American Deep South and even Mexico. Normally, we find a large but weak high pressure radiating out from the pole and kept in check by the jet stream, which diverts the coldest air from going further south. This year, weather maps for late January and early February show a kind of split in the high Arctic. There was a high pressure zone over Alaska and a super high over eastern Canadian Arctic. The big northern point of land, known as the Ungava Peninsula, north of Quebec, experienced temperatures up to 30 degrees Celsius above normal. The seas bordering the Ungava, which should be frozen solid, remained as open waters late into January, a record. Ice did not form along Labrador. Seals, which always have their pups on the ice, found none. Thousands of them calved on the beaches of Sable Island instead. High waves washed away and drowned many of the seal pups. Totally abnormal stuff. Scientists speculate the relatively hot weather may be related to the open water, but we don't know for sure. Between the two highs in Alaska and eastern Canada, there seemed to be a hole, a gap, where cold Arctic air poured south. Why didn't the jet stream blow it eastward? We don't know. Some of the cold met with wet air from the Gulf of Mexico and was blown east into New England, making a series of record snow dumps known as snowpocalypse. More cold air went down into Texas and into Mexico, where so much North American produce is now grown. Orange groves in Florida also got iced this winter. California had some cold spells and then some hot weather. That's about all I know until scientists get a chance to do more research, but we do know this isn't normal. I've already reported on the record-breaking storms that hit Australia, damaging agriculture there. I'll have more for you on that next week as we look at ocean heating. But just one more big underreported bit of news. The wheat-growing areas that feed a billion Chinese people have been hit with an unbelievable drought. I'm going to play you this quick clip from Al Jazeera this past week, one of the few news networks to cover the world outside the bubble of Western consumer life.
Rows and rows of young wheat crop, tufts amidst the dry brown land. They say it's the worst drought Shandong province has seen in 200 years. China's in a crisis, but this is one for the world to watch as well.
Food security in China affects food security globally, simply because of China's population. So if our production's cut and we begin importing food, that would raise the cost of food globally.
Officials have come up with the slogan, "Fight the drought, dig the well." At this site, they've been working for about a week now, and the plan is to dig 60 meters deep into the ground.
Pulling up groundwater to irrigate the fields. It's a strategy officials have deployed time and again. But by tackling one problem, they've created another. Groundwater in China is fast disappearing, with workers boring deeper and deeper every year. Depressions dot the North China Plain here, where the earth floor sinks into former water cavities. Combined with the fact much of the water in the country is polluted, that leaves very little fresh water for farmers to use and people to drink. Farmer Kong Linghe did not wait for the government to step in, but in desperation dug his own well to save his wheat crop.
In the beginning, I could pull water up every 2 days, then every 15. There's less and less.
After this, there is nothing else. When water tables fall, springs dry up, rivers stop flowing, and lakes disappear. The well-intentioned efforts here will actually dig China into a deeper hole. Melissa Chan, Al Jazeera, Shandong Province, China.
There goes my $5 loaf bread. I won't starve because the wheat crop in North America was good last year. The Russian wheat was 80% burned out. They stopped exporting. Over the past few months, we had predictions from Radio EcoShock guests, including Lester Brown, that the big wheat importers in North Africa would feel the price rise first and worst. Half the income of the young and the poor there goes for food. And guess what happened? Here is a simple formula I read in a blog. Energy equals food equals population. But is our energy running out? We go now to our interview with Dr. Jeremy Leggett. This civilization uses oil for its blood. Almost everything we make, buy, and use has oil in its food chain. You know that. Never mind we are bleeding carbon into the sky and the ocean or the developing climate shift. Even if oil was lily white, we are still running out of the cheap stuff, and we need that for our lifestyles. And we're determined, it seems, to drive right off that cliff without a plan B. Here to discuss all that, we have long-term energy watcher Dr. Jeremy Leggett. He was a geologist writing reports for big oil like BP and Shell. He was a Greenpeace climate campaigner for years, and now he's formed his own company, Solar Century, in Britain. He's written a book, Half Gone, Oil, Gas, Hot Air, and the Global Energy Crisis. And in the U.S., you find that as The Empty Tank. Jeremy Leggett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You publish a running digest of news called the Triple Crunch. Can you briefly describe what that is for us?
Yeah, I'm chairman of the company. I founded now, so I have a few hours every day to, you know, keep up with the dramas of what I think of as the Triple Crunch, or many people think of as the Triple Crunch. So that's the financial crisis, the climate crisis, and the energy crisis that are all interrelated in different ways. And I just post that on my personal website, hoping that it will help folk who are much busier than me, don't have the amount of time I do to keep up with these dramas that are so important to our future as a species.
Yes, we live in fascinating times. I've just grabbed a couple of entries from that log, and I wanted to start with this headline. It says, "Rising oil price threatens fragile oil economy." And if I could summarize it, it says, "The developed world is spending 33% more to import oil in 2010, more than the combined budget deficits of Greece and Portugal." And Fatih Birol says the rising oil prices in 2011 could bring us to another financial crisis. Jeremy, are we going broke trying to keep the fossil economy going?
Yeah, I believe we are. I think it's just a matter of time before it breaks us, because the conventional narrative that the oil industry can keep on producing rising supplies to stay ahead of demand in our oil-dependent civilization is just a narrative that more and more of us can't believe. And we think global oil production is going to drop. It's going to drop sometime soon on our watch in the next few years. And the oil price will become very volatile, but basically it'll go through the roof, and we just simply won't be able to afford to run oil-based economies the way we are at the moment.
And another analyst, Jeff Rubin, with the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, has suggested that rising oil costs could even lead to countries going bankrupt. Is that a fringe idea?
No, I think that's basically the sum of it, but I do believe that before that happens, we'll face a crunch, because oil-producing countries will come to realize that their narrative, the narrative that they're told, that there's plenty of oil they can keep on pumping, that too is flawed, and there'll be this kind of sweeping wave of realization in the world, the same way there was with the credit crunch. You know, we went within a matter of weeks from banks assuring us there was no risk with complex derivatives to a situation where everyone was panicking that the whole damn lot might be toxic. And I think the peak oil story at some point is going to play out the same way. So when that happens, the oil-producing countries will start husbanding their own resources. They'll start keeping it for themselves in ever-growing quantities. And that'll cause not just an energy crisis for many, perhaps most, oil-importing countries. It'll actually produce something more akin to an energy famine, and we really will be tested if that scenario plays out the way I fear.
Well, and I think one of the answers to that is to have some alternative energy, and I want to get to that a little later in this interview. But meanwhile, let's talk about Saudi Arabia and really the big news that's come out, partly due to WikiLeaks, that they may not have the reserves that they've been talking about to help us out if we need more oil. And we are using, well, the oil demand rose by 2.5 million barrels a day just last year.
Yeah, they're burning more and more oil in electric power plants, 1.25 million barrels a day at the moment. That's going up by 8% a year. And they're stating, senior officials are stating ever more openly that, you know, if they keep going at that rate, the exports are already dropping and they'll drop still further, notwithstanding peak oil. So I think what the WikiLeaks cables showed is not so much, you know, this wasn't news to people who follow the drama closely. And the gentleman who was quoted, Mr. Al-Husseini, you know, he's issued these kinds of warnings before. But what I think was new and interesting was the way that these American diplomats, obviously very clever, professional people, were reporting back in some state of alarm to the mothership in Washington that, crikey, you know, we don't believe that Saudi Arabia can keep pumping at the rates that would be needed to control the global oil price any longer. And that was new, because that's a narrative that is not on the mantra sheets of press officers in Washington or indeed any other capital.
I suppose it's old news to people who have followed peak oil that are in those circles that all of the Middle East countries appear to have grossly overstated their reserves. Why does that matter to us?
Well, it matters to the extent that, let's discount climate change for the moment, but if you're living in oil-dependent, nay, oil-addicted economies, and those economies are growing on the whole, and we're talking about the global picture here now, you've got to be able to keep oil supply in pace with demand. Otherwise, you get a shock, you get prices going through the roof, and all the other things I've talked about. And I think that's why it matters. It's failing we have, it seems, more and more as human beings, that we have some kind of blindness to depletion of natural resources collectively. And this particular one is going to hit us very hard.
And here's a frightening way that these problems interweave, though the press hardly reported it, as you noted. 2010 tied with the year 2005 as the hottest year on record, and as a result, there's more and more open water in the Arctic, and that leaves the far north open for more oil drilling, as we see in that BP Rosneft deal. How significant is that BP move into oil drilling in the Russian Arctic?
Coming there, they're having to go ever further into far-flung frontiers, and they're having to hook up with, you know, ever more, potentially unreliable partners. And the very fact that a few days after they announced their deal with Rosneft, which is Kremlin-owned oil company, making the Kremlin the single biggest shareholder in BP, can you imagine? The day after that happened, they then get sued by the oligarchs who own, you know, the TNK share of TNK BP, which is the big joint venture elsewhere in Russia looking for oil. And these business partners announced they're taking BP to court for breach of contract, etc., etc. So what a mess. I mean, that shows how desperate they are, I think, and it blows a clear whistle on the dangers of keeping going with this oil-addicted global economy.
It's pretty strange. I mean, we've seen that Putin can order the takeover of an oil company anytime, and yet BP is the single biggest supplier of oil to the U.S. military. So the Kremlin has control of the military supplies for America.
Yes, it's a world of paradoxes, is it not?
It is, and despite climate fears, we continue to burn more and more oil. You note in your log that it's up 2.8 million barrels a day in 2010 from just the year before, and it's like a big river of new carbon dioxide pouring into the atmosphere. Doesn't it seem like our green initiatives are really going nowhere?
Oh, no, I don't think nowhere. You know, it's certainly not happening fast enough, but there are all sorts of grains of hope around, and it's important for people who care about these issues to keep fighting, because I think there are fundamental non-linearities in the system, by which I mean, you know, just to use an example, you know, none of us saw the collapse of communism. You know, it just happened. It happened so quickly. Once it began to go, it was upon us, and, you know, crikey, there were no experts standing up and saying the Berlin Wall is about to come down, even days before it did. So I think that the clean tech revolution, the ability we have with current technologies to power our economies without producing emissions and without relying on overseas oil and gas and coal, all that is there. And many of these markets growing, as I know well from my day job, you know, because I set up the solar company, Solar Century, because I'm so worried about fossil fuel dependency. Well, people like me who are on this front line, we see how quickly this stuff can go. And I believe if we can just, you know, mix a bit of residual cleverness with, shall we say, a bit of luck, we might surprise ourselves.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with guest Dr. Jeremy Leggett, the campaigning geologist who founded his own solar company in Britain, Solar Century. Well, Jeremy, we talk about the possibilities of more solar, but I also notice that as the rising price of oil hurts world economies and the tax revenues to governments go down, and perhaps as a reaction to this and more fossil fuel lobby pressures, governments from the UK right through Europe to Australia have cut subsidies to solar energy, one of the few viable solutions. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the most popular subsidy is the feed-in tariff, which is a levy on all energy bills to pay a little bit of a premium price for solar. And they're supposed to be cut. I mean, they're designed to come down in tandem with the descent of cost and price in solar equipment, which is happening. I mean, between 2008 and 2010, in that three-year period, the average installed price of solar systems around the world came down 40%. So, you know, you don't want to keep your subsidies at the same level when you're dealing with that kind of cost down systemically in an industry. So all this is good news. And, of course, it points to the time, the inevitable time, when in every country solar electricity is going to be produced cheaper than electricity can be produced from brown sources, from fossil fuel sources, and in fact from nuclear. And in my own country, in the UK, the average price of conventional electricity in that same period, 2008 to 2010, has gone up 38% against solar prices going down 40%. This is another reason to be cautiously optimistic that if we can get our act together, we can haul ourselves, we can soften the damage from these triple crunch problems.
Let's talk about Australia just for a minute. Some scientists suggest that rising sea temperatures are adding both moisture and power to those weather systems that hit Australia time and again. In fact, there's another one right now coming on. The coal ports had to be shut for a while and the mines were flooded. I'm guessing as the world economy is hit over and over again, we may be able to do less and less about it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's the worrying scenario, that we leave ourselves in such a mess with escalating economic damage from the increasing effects of climate change, with debilitated economies because we're incapable of keeping our financial institutions under control and they go back in the casino and, you know, gamble our money away on our behalf and bring the world economy almost to its knees again as they did with the credit crunch. And on top of that, you have oil depletion causing, you know, the oil price to go through the roof. Yeah, you know, you can stitch together a really gruesome triple whammy that would make it incredibly difficult for us to mobilize the survival technologies, even if we had finally the will to do so. But, you know, it isn't certain to play out that way, and there's everything to go for in trying to stop that happening by presenting the arguments and mobilizing the survival technologies, and that's why I do the triple crunch log, and that's why I set up a solar energy company.
Meanwhile, there's a lot of backsliding in the United States, and I think Americans would have a heart attack reading the British parliamentary report calling for energy rationing by 2020. Do you think gas and oil rationing is really coming in this decade?
I think it's going to be inescapable, certainly from the point of view of oil. Gas maybe is a little bit more uncertain given some of the recent discoveries, but my prediction, and you know, people can call me up in 2012 and accuse me of being an irresponsible scaremonger if it's wrong, but I don't expect to be wrong here. I think we will live in times of rationing of oil, just as, you know, my parents had to do in the run-up to war. And I would say again, on the positive side, when we had to mobilize in those years in the late 1930s and 40s, my parents' generation in the United States and in Britain, you know, people were amazed at how quickly the necessary technologies and strategies and tactics were mobilized and the way people went along with that. So I think, you know, we will find the same thing when we're forced to mobilize in the face of the third and final great global oil crisis.
Jeremy Leggett, as you know, Americans pay less than half the price for gas at the pumps compared to Europeans. I'm wondering, how long can this imbalance go on, and what happens if we get some sort of price parity?
Well, you know, I have to admit that I don't think that those of us who believe in peak oil are going to win the argument. I think the groupthink on the other side is so strong. I think the desperation to believe the comforting narrative and cast aspersions at the uncomfortable narrative, which of course we saw in the run-up to the credit crunch and the way the investment banks poured scorn on people trying to blow whistles, even though history shows who was right in that. It's the same with oil and the peak oil story. So I fear what's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is that we're just simply going to find out who's right about peak oil. We're going to find out in a couple of years, and we will be tested then. We will have to mobilize. We will have no choice. We will have to mobilize low-carbon technologies much faster than we ever thought we'd have to do, even if we could get our act together collectively on climate change. You know, I live in a state of cautious optimism that once that happens, we will be able to find our way to some sort of renaissance by dint of the, you know, the innate civilizing characteristics of renewable energy when you've got local energy production and clean energy production. A lot of social good can come from that.
Are you pushing for huge, giant solar plants that spread over vast areas, or do you think there's still a market for smaller installations to make a difference?
Yeah, I don't think it's neither or. There will be, for sure, utility-scale power plants. There already are under construction, and, you know, there are reports that those under construction now in Southern California or planned in Southern California are going to be generating electricity that's already cheaper than gas. So there's, of course, there's a role for those kinds of plants. But, I mean, buildings, I would say this, wouldn't I, but this is what I passionately believe. Buildings are so perfectly suited to rooftop and facade solar, and I think that there is a fantastic resource there, especially when you hook solar technologies up with energy-efficient technologies.
If you had to pick a underreported news story for our audience, what comes to your mind?
Well, I think the state of electricity supply in Saudi Arabia might be near the top of my list. If people could see the pressure they're under and read some of the occasional reports of, you know, officials speaking out about what they're going to have to do, then I think there'll be a lot more concern. There was a gentleman the other day, I record it in the log, forget his name, but, you know, he was an ex-minister in the Saudi government, and he said, if Saudi Arabia keeps burning oil domestically at the rate it is at the moment, the growing rate it is at the moment, then, you know, within some years, I forget the exact figure, they're going to be burning 8 million barrels a day domestically, and there'll be virtually nothing left over for exports. So if that isn't a warning sign that should be galvanizing us all, I don't know what is.
This is a bit hilarious in a way. The Saudis say, well, we have to develop more solar and even more nuclear
exactly.
energy, and,
yeah.
and yet we don't get the message.
No, that's right.
Well, I'd hate to wrap up with total gloom. Can you fix us up with some more hopeful news on the solar front?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I come back to my point about what you can do with existing technology. A couple of weeks ago, with a big utility partner, big energy partner, Scottish and Southern, we opened a group of low-income houses here in the UK that are zero carbon and beyond. So they get all their electricity and a lot more besides, enough to charge up a communal electric car from solar roof tiles on the roof. And they get all the heating as well from any one of four renewable heating technologies, air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, wood chip boiler, and solar thermal. So, of course, you know, they're triple glazed, they're airtight, they've got A-grade lights and appliances. But just imagine, these things are standalone power plants. They produce no emissions. They use no oil, no gas, no coal, no nuclear. And they were put up in 8 months from breaking ground to connection to the grid. So when you see things like this, you sort of think to yourself, crikey, if we could just but half get our act together, just imagine what we could do to change the face of energy use and hence the global economy to make it more sustainable. So that's what gets me out of bed every morning, and there are countless more examples like that, of course.
We've been listening to one of the most informed minds on world energy, the green geologist, Dr. Jeremy Leggett. Find his website at jeremyleggett.net, and there are two G's and two T's in Leggett. And check out his Triple Crunch blog to find the key news stories your local media seldom reports. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.